Oh, I'm sure.
Okay, so hope everyone enjoyed the little break. We'll start things off with a couple questions from the audience, just to kind of get things going again. We'll try and take them one at a time because it's probably easier to digest that way. So the first question, is there an increasing demand among home buyers to favor higher density urban, new urban development? Is the trend increasing with the next generation of buyers? Anyone want to speak to that? Where's the market headed, at least locally?
Well,
or nationally?
That's a question that a lot of people would love to have answered. One thing we do know is that the millennials are actually driving less likely to be licensed to drive, more likely to move to urban environments. The tricky part we don't know is it's easy to think about doing that when you're in your 20s and you're single and living with friends or whatever. There was a story on the radio this morning that I did not hear the end of that was talking about the fact that the millennials are starting to buy houses. But I didn't hear where they're, what decisions they're making. Although I would say that one interesting thing locally on this is if you look at the Innovation Square project and the number, that's really an urban environment, and I'm not convinced that we have the urban amenities to support the needs and wishes of the population that we're attempting to attract to either stay in Gainesville or to come to Gainesville to work in those industries.
I can give you a brief synopsis on that. We have 5 kids at home, or coming and going, and they all don't want big houses. They're building a tiny house. They're downsizing. They don't want stuff. They just don't want it. They've watched us move stuff, do stuff, and they don't want to have stuff. So that's what I get from my 5 kids.
There's a George Carlin joke, I think. So two quick just kind of follow-ups. I think one is, I mean, at least some of what I've read, at least nationally, the trend is not just millennials, it's also the sort of post-children boomers whose kids have now left. They want to move, back into those downtown or downtown adjacent areas, places that at least have those urban-like amenities. So it's not, I think, just the younger segment, it's also, I think that middle segment might be the big question. And then the second thing I was going to say is locally, and this would be more specifically locally, I think, if you look at the types of development, and again, this is maybe anecdotal and maybe some of you could respond to this, but if you look at the types of developments that are happening, you see things like Town of Tioga, Celebration Point, those mixed use, again, some of those may be in the county or some of those may be within the municipality. Specifically City of Gainesville, but again, I think you do see, at least from my perspective, that may not be where the entire market is headed, but there is a growing section of the market that is looking for those at least urban-type amenities, even if it's not in the urban downtown core. Any thoughts on that from anyone else on the panel?
I would say that to some extent I'm not convinced the development community, based on my own personal experience, and interest in being a more urban environment, I don't think our development community really understands what that process is. I can only tell you when I first moved here, I said I wanted a more urban experience close to downtown or near the university. And I would be referred to Mill Pond, which doesn't have any mixed use. I would be referred to, I don't remember the other places, but in general, it was not a deep understanding of really how important it is. In order to take advantage of those urban amenities, you need density because that's where you get the critical mass to support a mix of land uses. A mix of uses means that you have more places to go so people can sort of do things on the way to places. And you need a good street grid so that you don't have to walk a long distance to go you don't have to walk a long distance to get from point A to B. And unless you have all of those together, I've done some research in Miami where we looked at trip distance, and you can really tell where urban amenities and how those three come together. If you don't have one, you don't have a fully functioning urban environment that's walkable. and works for people. I happen to eventually, when I bought a house, the tricky part is sort of the land market problem. Of it's quite more expensive to build in a more urban context. So I actually ended up in a 1960s house, but I can walk to the Publix and the Mill Harbor shopping area, which actually is probably one of the more walkable neighborhoods, although interestingly enough, there are no sidewalks.
Stuart, I think you were going to add something to that earlier.
There are a lot of statistics, both locally and nationally, in regards to what are the trends. The interesting aspect is when. What are those trends following over what time period? And whether you're following a whole generation or whether you're following multiple generations or following the current economic state of where we're going to be in the next year or next couple of years is the real difficult thing to understand and to try and figure out. The ability for us to provide the whole mix of housing types in order to appeal to all the market is where we're going to succeed. If we're regulating ourselves to only creating TNDs and TODs in certain stipulated pieces, then we're not going to be able to put the density there to handle the amenities, or we're not going to be able to build the amenities because the density is not there based on their size or their proximity to other regional centers or locations and being able to move to that. So to basically say that the only thing that we want in this community is the avoidance of vehicle-centric development is not what the market is actually saying or the market will ever say is across the board, that's the only way we can do it. We need to be able to provide to all the markets, both in the absolute rural, all the way to the highest density.
Anyone else?
I was going to comment. I wonder if it's better to look at the ages and the circumstance. When I was young and out of college, it was the urban experience. When I had kids, I moved to the school district and stayed there until middle school, and then in high school, there it's bust enough so it wasn't quite a locational thing. My suggestion is the schools need to be connected in this discussion because they are not often. And I think it's the critical driving force to for people's choices and for general happiness. Look at all of the contentious discussion that's going on with the school closures and the frustrations of not being able to go to the nearby school or walk or bike to school. I'd be happier if we really included schools with that discussion.
I'm going to second that, basically saying I think the challenge with schools, though, is pretty, it's somewhat difficult, and we probably need to think differently about schools in the sense that if a neighborhood is stable and has, you know, the neighbor, the we have two issues. One is we've facilitated school sprawl, and there is a whole discussion about that. For instance, I think our most recently built school at 98, I'm forgetting the name of it, Meadowbrook. There are so few children. I actually use that as an example of poor location of schools in my research. There's no neighborhoods around it. There's no kids that can walk to it. It might have the other, which goes back to my point about the importance of location. And you're busing all the kids in from Newberry and Alachua to get to the place in between. You're encouraging sprawl. So you build a school in the middle of nowhere, then the residential development happens around it. Instead of saying, school buildings are a resource in our community, and now I'm going to go back to my basic argument, which is that schools, if a neighborhood is stable, you would expect the neighborhood to have a decline in school populations at certain points. Because when the school is built, it will have lots of elementary school children, then it will have middle school children, then they will be in high school, and then there will, if it has a stable population and there's not a high rate of turnover. So when you look at something like Duval at the moment, there's lots of home property owners there. They're older. They don't have children. You look at Waldo, they don't have children. And you look at what can happen in a community when you close down schools is you make it more difficult to reinvest in that neighborhood. Unless we start to think of where cities, there are many places across the country that are thinking of schools as multi-purpose buildings so that you have senior citizen centers when the school age population declines. You have community centers so that you use the building for community services. They're much more integrated into the school, into the community, than ours are, where they're single purpose, they're for school children. And as soon as the population declines to the point we stop, we close them down. And we close down 40-year-old schools. Are we that wealthy that we can throw away public buildings?
My first job right out of school was to work for a firm that designed new towns. I lived in and worked on a project called Columbia, Maryland, which some of you may know. It's a start-from-scratch new town that was designed and built in the 60s. But the concept that was interesting was that the community had had one town center and seven village centers. And every village center was designed to have a small collection of retail. Most had groceries, not all. Most had an associated school. The school had facilities that served as the community center. The recreation facilities were both for the school and for the community, so there might have been a pool and some ball fields. And you could walk to school without ever crossing a street because there were
major streets,
that's true, but most of them anyway, because I walked to the grocery store. And so you could do that. It's an amazing thing. Even though it was start from scratch and we have a lot of hurdles to back in and retrofit, the concept of the school, the community center, the hub of short duration purchases and living in that context, you could eliminate so many trips that way and then have maybe the longer distance trip. The trips are significantly reduced. The schools were successful. You gathered there, they had festivities. It was really a neat idea, and it's not unlike what Ruth was describing.
I just wanted to comment. I know Meadowbrook is over capacity right now, and so are all the schools around it. They are coming out of the seam. So one of the things that would be good is, and you can't do it, is move the boundaries. But then you start moving boundaries for school to actually go where the population and shift the boundaries, then the real estate market will go crazy because the schools are designed. I mean, these homes in this area are designed to go to this school, and you want to move your zones and boundary lines, then everybody gets in an uproar. But the schools are full to the capacity. I know Meadowbrook is, there's so many.
But we aren't looking in the long term when you make those decisions about how schools are zoned.
Right.
Predict you go 20 years forward and you're going to have demand for schools on the east side of town. And we're acting like this is sort of a permanent situation, and we haven't really...
It moves. It
is
back
fluid.
And forth,
and I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying that we have to really reconceptualize how we think about those public assets.
So let's take maybe a couple more questions from citizens. Again, I'll just read them off here. How is the market manipulated so that sustainable practices aren't always viable? Do developers, et cetera, pay the full costs of the impacts? Anyone want to take that?
I guess that's for me. So markets are manipulated. I would disagree with that concept altogether. I mean, environmentally, the new products that are coming out, all the new innovations that are happening, I'm going to use LED lights as an example. LED lights are a great innovation. They last forever. They use low energy, but they're twice as much as a fluorescent light. I mean, that's just the simple facts. Low-E glass. It's just expensive. I would disagree that the market's manipulated. It's a new product. And as, you know, LED lights and those things gain traction, the price is going to come down. As demand goes up, the prices will come down. And those things are going to take hold and be a part of commonplace construction, you know, here in the near future. We're just not there yet. They're new, and new things cost more than old things, you know, typically.
Anyone else want to add anything to that?
I'll talk a little bit about the site. The interesting dilemma is that the development community has a number of different models, particularly in subdivisions. There are essentially speculators that find raw land and rezone it or get some of the entitlements in place, and then they sell it. Some developers are essentially infrastructure developers. They find the land, maybe they get the entitlements, and they build essentially the roads and drainage, and then they sell it or sell off parcels. And others are, I guess I'll call them master developers, that do turnkey, and they stay with the project all the time. The prior ones are in it for a shorter haul. So the challenge is finding ways to gain the benefit to the owner that buys the product and not create undue problems in that sequence of financial activities. But ultimately, we need to think about that end user, because if no one pays the sustainability dollar, the homeowner is the one that pays the price. And they may or may not go to LED lights. They may or may not know enough what landscape to install that doesn't create undue amount of fertilizer runoff and nitrogen and phosphorus problems. So it's a interesting and very complex system to find out some fair and reasonable way to get what we want without creating burdens that are unnecessary.
So a couple more questions. This is one referring to some statements from previous panelists at previous conversations. Do you think there's enough groundwater supply to support perpetual growth? If not, what solutions do you suggest? Again, previous panelists have suggested that there may not be. Anyone want to tackle that? Stuart.
Go, Stuart. You got it.
Water supply is obviously not only a local but a regional and a national issue. And based on my knowledge, expectation, and desires, it is not a supply issue, it's a cost of supply issue. We have significant volumes of water on both sides of our state. It's a cost to be able to desal in order to get that water. We'd rather use the groundwater that we have in our locality or in the aquifer that's already fresh, that it's much cheaper for us to treat and use that water. One of the scenarios is that our entire world is actually full, encapsulated, and we don't reduce or increase the amount of water we have. It's just in different places and in different qualities at different times. So for us to recognize whether we got perpetual growth availability of water, the answer is always yes. It's just what we're going to pay for it. We're paying over $1 a bottle now. We're paying more for water than we are than gasoline in some certain situations. So is it the cost of it, or is it the quantity? And the answer is it's the cost that you're going to pay for the quantity, which leads into the question of what about GRE rates?
So maybe before we get to some of those other questions, we'll take a couple from the list of questions that we've been working from. So previous panelists have suggested, and previously in the county it was proposed that there be a stormwater fee to help pay for infrastructure upgrades or permitting review by county staff. would any of your, would any of you be for or against that fee, and why? Anybody?
I guess since water resources is my main focus, stormwater falls very well into that, and most of us that have lived or worked in the city know that the city does have a stormwater fee, and the city does charge for that, and any development that is done in a regional stormwater basin area, you pay into that in order to be able to have that user availability. Stormwater historically has been considered something to deal with and not a utility, not a need or a consideration near as much as we should have over the years. The county qualities in our natural environment depend significantly on what we do with the stormwater that has been deteriorated by the impact on our built environment. And I do recognize the fact that we need to be able to address it, and it is a common community issue rather than an individual developer-based issue, and therefore applicable stormwater fee that has the appropriate mechanisms to be reduced when there's a regional basin, regional stormwater treatment facility, or a facility that allows the treatment to be higher quality before it leaves the site themselves is applicable, rather than just charging a flat fee in order to be able to increase the revenues.
So that gets sort of, I think, to the point you made earlier about flexibility, right? So having ways to change how that fee is applied based on data that can be provided on a specific basis. Glenn, do you have a comment there?
It would be wonderful if all of the county understood the water cycle and the relationship of water consumption, water treatment, stormwater runoff, and the prices that we pay to deliver drinking water, deal with our stormwater, our effluent disposal, our runoff. And a great story is one of the Sweetwater Branch, where much of the old part of Gainesville had been paved over at a time when stormwater wasn't a fully comprehended issue. And now with the Sweetwater Branch Paint Prairie Sheet Flow Project is essentially dealing with those, I don't know, 60 to 80 years of issues and impairments to make it right, and it's a great model, but it certainly is a historic story to understand consumption, degradation, stormwater runoff, the heavy metals and other discharge impediments in that, and the dilemma of the Alachua sink that goes directly to our drinking water. So I see no reason that we should be frustrated with the stormwater fee. What we really need to do is understand all of the components of the hydrologic cycle and what we pay, and make sure that everybody is sharing and being responsible, and not just one entity like we like to pick on the developer and say, please pay for everything. That's not fair. When residents are overwatering and over-fertilizing and letting that go directly into the gutter and then back into our receiving waters.
So just as a follow-up to that, and you kind of beat me to the follow-up question in some way, but so with these growing questions about water quality, quantity, and looking to examples like the sheet flow restoration project or in a more municipal level, the recent swales along Main Street, what are those opportunities that are out there for green infrastructure like that? Are there other areas that would be, you know, again, to kind of follow up with that we could, you know, implement those kinds of projects or things we could do to encourage those kinds of projects?
at the site level, every resident could have depressional storage in their lawns, and I'm talking subtle little rain gardens. That helps. They can be mindful of the landscapes that they implement, that there aren't too many plants that absolutely need fertilizer except for sod and other non-natives that make their way in. And just be mindful of those tools in the commercial development side and institutional projects. Then the projects that we're seeing that are implementing bioswales and other forms of bioremediation are useful things, and that collectively removes some of the volume off of the collection point and onto our systems, or in other cases can remediate by filtering sediment or some amounts of heavy metals and nitrogen and phosphorus. But if we all did that, as each resident and business did, then the responsibilities we would have, both from a supply side and from a water quality side, would be much less significant than what we spend now. Green roofs are perceived as a luxury. They're a way of removing volume, pretty significant volume.